Jibril was lying on his back, stark naked. "His name," said Jibril, "Regal. He's got that white spot on his throat, and a wet nose, right?"
"The very one."
"Regal, you've been adopted, Ravel. Ain't that ironic?" My life's ambition realized at last. Locke glanced around the half-empty undercastle. Several of the new orchids were snoring loudly. One or two were crawling to their feet, and at least one was sleeping contentedly in a pool of his own vomit. Or so Locke assumed. Jean was nowhere to be seen. "And how was your evening, Ravel?" Jibril pushed himself up on both elbows. "Virtuous, I think." "My condolences." Jibril smiled. "You ever met Malakasti from the Blue Watch? Got the sort of red hair and the daggers tattooed on her knuckles? Gods, I don't think she's human."
"You vanished early from the party, I'll say that."
"Yeah. She had some demands, and some friends." Jibril massaged his temples with his right hand. "That bosun from Red Watch, fellow with no fingers on his left hand, had no idea they taught gods-fearing Ashmiri lads them sorts of tricks. Phew!"
"Lads? I didn't know you, stalked that particular quarry."
"Yeah, well, seems I'll try anything once," Jibril grinned. "Or five or six times, as it turns out."
He scratched his belly and seemed to become aware of his lack of clothes for the first time.
"Hell, I remember owning breeches as recently as yesterday."
Locke emerged into sunlight a few minutes later with Regal still tucked under his arm. As Locke stretched and yawned, the cat did the same, attempting to wriggle out of Locke's grasp and presumably climb back atop his head. Locke held the tiny fellow up and stared at him.
"I'm not getting attached to you," he said. "Find someone else to share your drool with."
Well aware that any mistreatment of the little fellow might get him thrown over the side, he set the kitten down and nudged him with a bare foot.
"You sure you're authorized to give orders to that cat?"
Locke turned to find Jean standing on the forecastle steps, just finishing pulling a tunic on.
"Gotta be careful. He might be a watchmate."
"If he acknowledges any rank, I think he puts himself somewhere between Drakasha and the 12. Locke stared up at Jean for several seconds. "Hi."
"Hello."
"Look, there's a lot of tedious, I was an ass sort of conversation to stumble through, and I'm still feeling a bit victimized by that blue wine, so let's just assume..."
"I'm sorry," said Jean.
"No, that's my job."
"I meant, we really found our jagged edges again, didn't we?"
"If there's one thing a battle isn't, it's calming on the nerves. I don't blame you for what you said."
"We can think of something," said Jean quietly and urgently. "Something together. I know you're not... I didn't mean to insult you."
"I deserved it, and you were right. I spoke to Drakasha last night."
"You did?"
"I told her." Locke grimaced, stretched again, used the motion to cover a series of hand signals. Jean followed, his eyebrows rising. "Didn't mention Bonds Magi, Sinspire, Camor, real names. All else, truth."
"Really?" said Jean.
"Yes." Locke stared down at the deck. "I said you were right."
"And how did she..."
Locke mimed a roll of the dice and shrugged. "We're for Port Prodigal before anything else happens," he said. "Chores to do." Then she said, "She'll let us know."
"I see. And so..."
"Did you have a good night?"
"Gods, yes."
"Good. About, what I said yesterday."
"You don't need..."
"I do. It was the dumbest of all the things I said yesterday. Dumbest and least fair. I know I've been hopeless for so long I wear it like armor. I don't begrudge you anything you have. Savor it."
"I do," said Jean. "Believe me, I do."
Good. I'm no one you want to learn from. So... All's well, Master Valora. Locke smiled, pleased to feel the corners of his mouth creeping up of their own volition. But that wine I was talking about...
Wine? Did you...
Crap lines, Jerome. I need to piss before my innards explode. You're blocking the stairs.
Ah.
Jean stepped down and slapped Locke on the back. My apologies. Free yourself, brother.
Chapter 12. Port Prodigal. 1. The poison orchid bore west by south through muggy air and moderate seas, and the days rolled by for Locke in a rhythm of chores. He and Jean were placed on the Red Watch, which had been put under Lieutenant Del Mastro's direct oversight in Nazreen's absence. Grand initiation ceremonies did nothing to sate the ship's appetite for maintenance. The masts still needed to be slushed, the seams checked and rechecked, the decks swept, the rigging adjusted. Locke oiled sabers from the weapons lockers, heaved at the capstan to shift cargo for better trim, served ale at the mid-evening meals, and pulled rope fragments to oakum until his fingers were red. Drakasha acknowledged Locke with terse nods, but said nothing, and summoned him to no more private conversations. As full crew, the ex-messengers had the right to sleep more or less where they would. Some opted for the main hold, especially those who claimed willing hammock partners among the old orchids, but Locke found himself comfortable enough with the now roomier undercastle. He won a spare tunic in a game of dice and used it as a pillow, a luxury after days of bare deck alone. He slept like a stone statue after finishing each night's watch just before the red light of dawn. Jean, of course, slept elsewhere after the night watches. They had no sightings through the 25th of the month, when the winds shifted and began to blow strongly from the south. Locke had collapsed into his usual spot against the undercastle's larboard wall at sunrise, and then snored for several hours in the fashion of the eminently self-satisfied, until some sort of commotion awoke him, and he found Regal draped across his neck.
"Gah!"
he said, and the kitten took this as a signal to perch his forepaws on Locke's cheeks and begin poking his wet nose directly between Locke's eyes. Locke seized the kitten, sat up, and blinked. His skull felt full of cobwebs. Something had definitely woken him prematurely.
"Was it you?"
he muttered, frowning and rubbing the top of Regal's skull with two fingers.
"We have to stop meeting like this, kid. I'm not getting attached to you."
"Land ho!"
came a faint cry from outside the undercastle. 3 points off the larboard bow!" Locke set Regal down, gave him an unambiguous nudge toward some other snoring sleeper, and crawled out into the morning light. Activity on deck seemed normal. Nobody was rushing about or delivering urgent messages to Drakasha, or even crowding the rail to try to spot the approaching land. Someone slapped Locke on the back, and he turned to find himself facing Utgar, who had a coil of rope slung over his shoulder. The Vadran nodded in a friendly fashion.
"You look confused, Red Watch."
"It's just, I heard the cry. I thought there'd be more excitement. Will that be Port Prodigal?"
"Nah, it's the ghost winds, right? But we're just fetching the edges. Miserable places. Asp Island, Bastard Rock, the Opal Sands, nowhere we'd want to touch. 2 days yet to Prodigal, and with the winds like this, we're not getting in the way we'd like, hey?"
"What do you mean?"
"You'll see,"
Utgar grinned, enjoying some private knowledge.
"You'll see for damn sure. Get your beauty sleep, right? You're back on the masts in 2 hours."
2. The Ghost Wind Isles gradually crowded in around the orchid like a gang of muggers savoring their slow approach to a target. The horizon, once clear, sprouted islands thick with mist-capped jungle. Tall black peaks rumbled intermittently, belching lines of steam or smoke into the heavy grey skies.
rain washed down in sheets, not the merciless storms of the high seas, but rather the indifferent sweat of the tropics, blood warm and barely pushed by the jungle breeze. The waters lightened with their passage west, from the cobalt of the deeps to sky blue to translucent aquamarine. The place was teeming with life. Birds wheeled overhead, fish darted through the shallows in silver clouds, and sinuous shapes larger than men shadowed them. They stalked languidly in the orchid's wake as well. Scythe sharks, blue widowers, bad luck reef men, dagger fins. Eeriest of all were the local wolf sharks, whose sand-colored backs made them vanish into the pale haze below the ship. It took a keen eye to spot the ghostly incongruities that betrayed their lurking, and they had the disconcerting habit of circling beneath the crap lines. Locke thanked the gods that they weren't jumpers. For a day and a half they sailed on, heeling over to dodge the occasional reef or smaller island. Dracasha and Delmastro seemed to know the area by heart and muttered over Dracasha's charts only at rare intervals. Locke began to glimpse human detritus on the shoals and rocks. Here a weathered mast, there the skeletal ribs of an ancient keel on the sandy bottom. On one afternoon watch, he spotted hundreds of crab-like things the size of dogs congregating on the overturned bottom of a ship's hull. As the orchid passed, the creatures fled from their artificial reef en masse, making the water around it froth white. In moments they had vanished completely. Locke went off that watch a few hours later, aware of a steadily growing tension in the crew around him. Something had changed. Dracasha paced the quarterdeck ceaselessly, ordered extra lookouts to the mastheads, and held whispered conferences with Delmastro and Mumchance. "She won't tell me what's going on," said Jean, after Locke dropped what he thought was a subtle hint. "She's all lieutenant and no Ezri at the moment." "That in itself tells us something," said Locke. "Tells us to curb our good cheer." Dracasha mustered all hands at the evening watch change. All the orchids, one vast, sweaty, anxious mass of men and women, fixed their eyes on the quarterdeck rail and waited for the captain's words. The sun was a disk of burning copper crowning jungle heights dead ahead. The colors of fire were creeping up layer by layer through the clouds, and all around them the islands were falling into shadow. "Well," said Dracasha, "here it is, plain. The winds have been steady as hell these past few days, out of the south. We can drop anchor in Prodigal tonight, but we can't make it through the Trader's Gate." There was a general murmur from the crowd. Lieutenant Delmastro, stepping up beside the captain, placed a hand on her weapons belt and hollered, "Quiet! Perelandro's piss! Most of us have been here before." "So we have," said Dracasha. "Stout hearts, orchids. We'll do the usual. Red watch, take some ease. Expect an all-hands call in a few hours. After that, nobody sleeps, nobody drinks, nobody fucks until we're safe home again. Blue watch, you have the duty. Del, see to the newcomers. Run it all down for them." "Run what down?" Locke looked around, asking the question to the air as the crew dispersed. "Two passages to get to Port Prodigal," said Jabril. "First, Trader's Gate, that's north of the city. 12 miles long, say. Twists and turns, shoals all over the place. Slow going at the best of times. But with a hard south wind, piss on it. It'll take us days."
"So what the hell are we doing?"
"Second way, from the west, half as long. Still twisty, but ain't near so bad, especially with this wind. But it don't get used if anyone can help it. They call it the Parlor Passage."
"Why?"
"Because there's something there," said Lieutenant Delmastro, pushing her way through the little crowd, ex-messengers all that had gathered around Jabril. Locke saw her give Jean's arm the briefest squeeze, and then she continued. "Something lives there."
"Something?" Locke couldn't keep a hint of irritation out of his voice. "Is the ship in danger?"
"No," said Del Mastro. Let me be more specific, then. Are those of us aboard her in danger? I don't know, said Del Mastro, sharing a glance with Jabril. Will something come aboard the ship? No, absolutely not. Might you feel like leaving the ship? I can't say. Depends on your temperament. I'm not sure I'd enjoy the close attention of anything swimming in these waters, said Locke. Good. Then you probably don't have anything to worry about. Del Mastro sighed. All of you, think on what the captain said. A bit of rest is the thing. You'll be called up halfway through your usual off-watch, so snatch what you can. She stepped up beside Jean, and Locke overheard her whisper, I certainly intend to. I'll find you later then, Jerome. Locke smiled despite himself. You going to catch a nap? Asked Jean. Bloody hell, no. I expect to twiddle my thumbs and go steadily out of my skull until called for duty. Maybe I can find someone to share a hand of cards. Doubt it, said Del Mastro. Your reputation... Unjust persecution for my good fortune, said Locke. Yeah, well, maybe you should consider a public streak of bad luck. Word to the wise. She blew Locke a mocking little kiss. Or whatever you are, Ravel. Oh, steal Jerome and go do your worst to him. Locke folded his arms and grinned. Del Mastro's loosening up toward him had been a welcome change over the previous few days. I'll be judging your performance by how pissed Tregane is when we see her next. Hell, that's how I can amuse myself. I'll solicit wagers on how riled up you two can get the scholar. You do anything of the sort, said Del Mastro, and I'll chain you to an anchor by your precious bits and have you dragged over a reef. No, this is a good scheme, said Jean. We could place our own bets with him, then rig the contest. This ship has two anchors, Fellora. 3. Dusk was approaching by the time Jean and Ezri crept back up to the quarterdeck. Dracasha stood near the taffrail, cradling Cosetta in her left arm and holding a small silver cup in her right.
You must drink it, love, whispered Dracasha. It's a special nighttime drink for pirate princesses.
No, muttered Cosetta.
Are you not a pirate princess?
No.
I think you are. Be good.
Don't want.
Jean thought back to his time in Camor, and to how chains had sometimes behaved when one of the young gentleman bastards had decided to throw a fit. They'd been much older than Cos, true, but children were children, and Dracasha looked hollow-eyed with worry.
My, my, he said loudly, approaching the Dracashas so that Cosetta could see him. That looks very good, Captain Dracasha.
It does look very good, she said, and it tastes better than it looks.
Heh, said Cosetta. Ah, no!
You must, said her mother.
Captain, said Jean, pretending to be entranced by the silver cup, that looks so wonderful. If Cosetta doesn't want it, I'll have it.
Dracasha stared at him and then smiled.
Well, she said, sounding grudging, if Cosetta doesn't want it, I suppose I have no choice.
She slowly moved the cup away from Cosetta and toward Jean, and the little girl's eyes grew wide.
No, she said, no.
But you don't want it, said Dracasha with an air of finality. Jerome does, so it's going away, Cosetta.
Hmm, said Jean, I'll drink it straight away.
No!
Cosetta stretched for the cup.
Cosetta, said Dracasha sternly,
if you want it, you must drink it. Do you understand?
The little girl nodded, her mouth an O of concern, her fingers straining to reach the suddenly invaluable prize. Zamira held the silver cup to Cosetta's lips, and the little girl drained it with urgent greed.
Very good,
said Drakasha, kissing her daughter on the forehead. Very, very good. Now I'm going to take you down so you and Paolo can go to sleep. She slipped the empty silver cup into a coat pocket, slung Cosetta round to the front of her chest, and nodded at Jean.
Thank you for that, Valora. Deck is yours, Del. Just a few minutes.
She hates doing that, said Ezri quietly when Drakasha had vanished down the companionway.
Feeding Cos for the night?
It's milk of poppy. She puts them both to sleep, for the parlour passage. No way in hell she wants them awake when we go through it.
What the hell is going to...
It's hard to explain, said Ezri. It's easier just to get it over with. But you'll be fine. I know you will.
She ran one hand up and down his back.
You managed to survive me in my poorer moods.
Ah, said Jean, but when a woman has your heart, she doesn't have poor moods, only interesting moods, and more interesting moods.
Where I was born, obnoxious flatterers were hung out to dry in iron cages.
I can see why you ran away. You inspire such flattery that any man who talked to you at length would have been caged up after...
You are beyond obnoxious.
I need to do something to keep my mind off whatever's coming.
What we just did below wasn't enough.
Well, I suppose we could always go back down and...
Alas, that the biggest bitch on this ship isn't even Drakasha or myself, but duty.
She kissed Jean on the cheek.
You want something to keep yourself busy? You can get started with preparations for the passage. Get to the forward lantern locker and bring me the alchemical lights.
How many?
All of them, she said. Every last one you can find.
4. The 10th hour of the evening. Night fell like a cloak over the ghost winds, and the poison orchid, under topsails, stood into the parlour passage gilded in white and amber light. 100 alchemical lanterns had been shaken to life and placed around the ship's entire hull, a few in the rigging but most beneath the rail, casting rippling facets of false fire on the dark water just below.
"By the deep six!" called one of the two sailors Drakasha had placed at the sides, where they cast their lead lines to gauge the amount of water between the ship's hull and the sea bottom.
6 fathoms, 36 feet. The orchid could slip through far shallower straits than that. Ordinarily, soundings were occasional, and one leadsman would suffice to take them. Now the men, two of her oldest and most experienced, cast their lines and called the results continually. What's more, each of them was watched by a small party of minders, was the best word Jean could come up with, sailors who were armed and armoured. Strange precautions had been ordered all over the ship. The small elite crew who waited above to work the sails had safety lines lashed around their waists. They would dangle like pendulums if they fell, but at least they'd probably live. Real fires were extinguished, smoking strictly forbidden. Drakasha's children slept in her cabin with the stern shutters locked and the companionway door guarded. Drakasha herself had her elderglass mosaic vest buckled on, and her sabres hung ready in their scabbards.
"A quarter less six!" called a leadsman.
"Fog coming up," said Jean. He and Locke stood at the starboard rail of the quarterdeck. Drakasha paced nearby. Mumchance had the wheel, and Del Mastro stood by the binnacle with a small rack of precision timing glasses.
"That's how it starts," said Mumchance.
The orchid was entering a mile-wide channel between cliffs that rose to about half the height of the masts, and was surmounted by dark jungle that rose and faded into the blackness. There were faint sounds of things unseen in that jungle, screeches, snapping, rustling. The ship's arcs of lanterns made the waters around them clear for 50 or 60 feet, and at the edges of that gleaming circle Jean saw threads of grey mist beginning to curl out of the water.
"And a half five!" came the cry from the starboard leadsman.
Captain Drakasha!
Utgar stood at the taffrail, log line pinched between his fingers.
4 knots, hey?
Aye, said Drakasha. 4 knots, and our sterns even with the mouth of the passage. Give me 10 minutes, Del. Del Mastro nodded, flipped one of her glasses over, and kept watch as sand began to trickle from the upper chamber to the lower. Drakasha moved to the forward quarterdeck rail.
"Heed this," she said to the crewfolk working or waiting on deck. "If you start to feel peculiar, stay away from the rails. If you cannot abide the deck, go below. This is a chore we must endure, and we've come through it before. You cannot be harmed if you stay on the ship. Hold fast to that thought. Do not leave the ship."
The mist was rising now, layering upon itself. The shadowy outlines of cliffs and jungles beyond were swiftly vanishing. Before them was nothing but blackness.
10, Captain, said Del Mastro at last.
By the mark 5, cried one of the leadsmen.
Mum, put your helm down. Drakasha used a stick of charcoal to scrawl a quick note on a folded parchment. 2 spokes alee.
Aye, Captain. Helm alee by 2.
At the sailing master's slight adjustment to the wheel, the ship leaned to larboard. Sailors overhead made faint adjustments to sails and rigging, acting on instructions Drakasha had drilled into them before they'd entered the passage.
Give me 12 minutes, Del.
Aye, Captain. 12 it is.
As those 12 minutes passed, the fog grew thicker, like smoke from a well-fed fire. It closed on either side, a swirling grey wall that seemed to lock their own light and sound in a bubble, closing off all hint of the outside world. The creak of the blocks and rigging, the slap of the water on the hull, the babble of voices, all these familiar things echoed flatly, and the jungle noises vanished. Still the fog encroached, until it crossed the ephemeral line of well-lit water created by the lanterns. Visibility in any direction now died at 40 feet.
12, Captain, said Del Mastro.
Mum, put up your helm, said Drakasha, staring at the compass in the binnacle.
Helm aweather. Bring us northwest by west.
She shouted to the crewfolk at the waist.
Make ready to shift yards. Northwest by west. Wind to the larboard quarter.
There were several minutes of activity as the ship came slowly around to its new course, and the crew rebraced the yards. All the while, Jean became more convinced that he wasn't imagining the sound-dampening nature of the fog. The noise of their activity simply died when it hit that shroud. In fact, the only evidence of a world beyond the mist was the wet, earthy smell of jungle blowing in with the warm breeze across the quarterdeck.
By the mark 7, called a leadsman.
22 minutes, Del.
Aye, said Del Mastro, turning her glasses like an automaton. The next 22 minutes passed in claustrophobic silence, punctuated only by the occasional flutter of sail canvas and the shouts of the leadsmen. Tension built as the minutes crawled by, until...
Time, Captain.
Thanks, Del. Mum, put your helm down. Bring us southwest by west. She raised her voice.
Lively now! Tacks and sheets! To the larboard tack, southwest by west!
Sails shuddered, and crewfolk ran about swearing and working ropes as the ship heeled back onto the larboard tack. They spun at the heart of the fog. The jungle-scented breeze seemed to rotate around them like a boxer dancing around an opponent, until Jean could feel it against his left cheek.
"Hold steady, Mum," said Drakasha.
"Isri, 15 minutes.
15, aye.
Here it fucking comes, muttered Mumchance.
Belay that crap, said Drakasha. Only thing truly dangerous out here is us, got it?
Jean felt a prickling sensation on the skin of his forehead. He reached up and wiped away the sweat that was beading there.
A quarter less 5, called a leadsman.
Jean.
whispered a faint voice.
What, Orin?
Huh? Locke was gripping the rail with both hands and barely spared a glance for Jean.
What did you want?
I didn't say anything.
Are you...
Jean Tannen.
Oh, gods, said Locke.
You too?
Jean stared at him. A voice.
Not from the air, whispered Locke.
More like you know who, back in Camor.
Why is it saying my...
It's not, said Drakasha in a low, urgent voice. We all hear it talking to us. We all hear our own names. Hold fast.
Crooked Warden, I will fear no darkness, for the night is yours, muttered Locke, pointing the first two fingers of his left hand into the darkness.
The dagger of the 13th, a thief's gesture against evil. Your knight is my cloak, my shield, my escape from those who hunt to feed the noose. I will fear no evil, for you have made the knight my friend.
Bless the benefactor, said Jean, squeezing Locke's left forearm. Peace and profit to his children.
Jean Esteban Tannen.
He felt the voice, realizing somehow that the impression of sound was just a trick he played upon himself, an echo in his ears. He felt its intrusion into his awareness like the brush of insect legs against his skin. He wiped his forehead again and realized that he was sweating profusely, even for the warm night. Forward, someone started sobbing loudly.
12,
Jean heard Ezri whispering.
12 more minutes. The water is cool, Jean Tannen. You sweat, your clothes itch, skin itch, but the water is cool.
Drakasha squared her shoulders and strolled down the quarterdeck steps to the waist. She found the sobbing crewman, hauled him gently to his feet, and gave him a pat on the back.
Chins up, orchids! This isn't flesh and blood. This isn't a fight. Stand fast!
She sounded bold enough. Jean wondered how many of her crew knew or guessed that she drugged her children rather than put them through this. Was it merely Jean's imagination, or was the fog lightening to starboard? The haze was no thinner, but the darkness behind it seemed to abate, to acquire a sickly luminescence. A whispering hiss of water grew into a steady, rhythmic pulse, waves breaking over shoals. The black water rippled at the edge of their little circle of light.
The reef, muttered Mum Chance.
By the deep four, called a leadsman.
Something stirred in the fog, the faintest impression of movement. Jean peered at the swirling gloom, straining to catch it again. He rubbed at his chest, where his sweat-soaked tunic seemed to irritate the skin beneath.
Come to the water, Jean Tannen. Water so cool. Come, lose tunic, lose sweat, lose itch. Bring the woman. Bring her with you to the water. Come.
Gods, whispered Locke, whatever's out there knows my real name.
Mine as well, said Jean.
I mean, it's not calling me Locke. It knows my real name.
Oh, shit.
Jean stared down at the black water and heard the sound of it breaking over the unseen reef. It couldn't be cool. It had to be as warm as everything else in this damn place. But the sound... The sound of those waves was not so unpleasant. He listened, entranced for several seconds, then raised his head lethargically and stared into the fog. Something was there, for the briefest instant, a dark shape visible through the curtains of mist, man-sized, tall, thin, and motionless, waiting there atop the reef. Jean shuddered violently, and the shape disappeared. He blinked as though waking from a daydream. The fog was now as dark and solid as ever, the imagined light gone, the hissing rush of water over shoals no longer so pleasing to his ears. Sweat ran in itching streams down his neck and arms, and he welcomed the distraction, scratching himself furiously.
By the deep four, and a quarter four, murmured a leadsman.
Time, said Esri, seeming to come out of a daze of her own. Time, time.
Surely not, muttered Locke. That wasn't but a few minutes.
I looked down and the sands were run out. I don't know when it happened.
She raised her voice urgently.
Captain, time!
Rouse up, rouse up! Drakasha bellowed as though the ship were under attack.
Tacks and sheets! Come west by north! Wind to the larboard quarter! Brace the yards!
West by north, aye, said Mumchance.
I don't understand,
said Esri, staring at her timing glasses. Jean saw that her blue tunic was soaked with sweat, her hair was matted, and her face was slick.
I was watching the glasses. It was like I just blinked and all the time was gone.
The deck was alive with vigorous commotion. Once more the breeze shifted, the fog swirled around them, and Mumchance settled them onto their new course with precise, almost delicate shifts of his wheel.
Gods, said Esri. That one was as bad as I can remember.
Never been like that before, added Mumchance.
How much longer? Asked Jean, not ashamed to sound anxious.
That's our last turn, said Esri, assuming we didn't slip south far enough that we run aground on something in these next few minutes. It's straight on west by north all the way to Port Prodigal.
They slipped on through the dark waters, and gradually the strange sensations on Jean's skin ebbed. The fog withdrew, first opening into cleaner darkness before the ship, and then unravelling behind them. The light from the lanterns seemed to pour back out into the night, unrestrained, and the reassuring noise of the jungle on either side of the channel returned.
By the deep eight, came a leadsman's shout.
That's the main channel, said
Drakasha, ascending the steps to the quarterdeck once again.
Well done, everyone!
She turned to look out over the waste.
Take in most of the lanterns. Leave a few out for navigation so we don't surprise anyone coming into the harbour. Keep the leads going.
She reached out and put her arms on Mumchance and Esri, squeezing their shoulders.
I know I said no drinking, but I think we could all do with a brace.
Her gaze fell on Locke and Jean.
You two look as though you could use a job. Fetch up an ale cask and serve it out at the mainmast.
She raised her voice to a shout.
Half a cup for anyone who wants it!
As Jean hurried forward with Locke close behind, he was pleased to feel the tension of a few moments earlier evaporating. Crew folk were smiling again, chattering away at one another, even laughing here and there. A few kept to themselves, arms folded and eyes downcast, but even they seemed relieved. The only odd thing about the scene, Jean realized, was how assiduously most of them seemed to be trying to keep their attention focused on the ship and the people around them. More than an hour would pass before many of them would allow themselves to glance out at the water again. 5. If you could stand on air 1,000 feet above Port Prodigal this midnight, you would see a tenuous ribbon of light set like a jewel in the midst of boundless tropical darkness. Clouds veil the moons and the stars. Even the thin red lines of volcanic flow that sometimes ignite the far horizons are missing. Those dark mountains smoulder tonight without visible fire. Prodigal claims a long beach on the north side of a vast hilly island. Miles of ancient rainforest recede into the night behind it. Not a speck of light burns anywhere within that grim expanse. The broad harbour, enclosed on all sides, is uncommonly friendly to ships once they slip through either of the arduous passages that bring them from the sea. There are no reefs, no smaller islands, no navigational hazards marring the sandy white bottom of the bay. At the eastern end of town, the water shallows to waist depth, while in the west, even heavy ships may all but kiss the shore and keep 8 or 9 fathoms beneath their keels. A forest of masts rocks gently above these depths, a floating hodgepodge of docks, boats, working ships, and hulls in every state of disrepair. There are two loosely defined anchorages serving Port Prodigal. First, the graveyard, where float the hundreds of hulls and wrecks that will never move on the open sea again. East of that, claiming all the larger, newer docks, lies the hospital, so called because its patients may yet live. 6. A bell began tolling, its slow clang echoing off the water as soon as the poison orchid emerged from the parlor passage. Locke stared over the ship's larboard rail toward the lights of the city and their rippling reflections on the bay.
"Harbor watch shall ring that damn thing until we drop anchor."
Jabril had taken note of his curiosity and taken the rail beside him.
"Gotta let everyone know they're on the job so they keep getting paid their liquor ration."
"You spend much time here, Jabril?"
"Born here. Prison in Talvara is what I got the one time I tried to see some other oceans."
Dropping anchor in Prodigal Bay had none of the ceremony Locke had seen elsewhere. No shore pilots, no customs officers, not even a single curious fisherman. And, to his surprise, Drakasha didn't take the orchid all the way in. They settled about half a mile offshore, furled sails, and kept their lanterns burning.
"Drop a boat to larboard," ordered Drakasha, peering at the city and its anchorages through her glass. "Then rig razor nets at the starboard. Keep lanterns burning. Dismiss blue watch below, but have sabers ready at the masts. Del, get Malakasti, Dantier, Big Corner, and Rask."
"You're well, Captain."
After helping a work party heave one of the ship's larger boats over the side, Locke approached Drakasha on the quarterdeck and found her still studying the town through her glass.
"I take it you have reason for caution, Captain?"
"We've been out for a few weeks," said Drakasha, "and things change. I've got a big crew and a big ship, but neither of them is the biggest there is."
"Do you see something that makes you nervous?"
"Not nervous. Curious. Looks like most of us are home for once. See that line of ships at the eastern docks, closest to us? 4 of the council captains are in town. 5, now that I'm back."
She lowered her glass and looked sidelong at him.
"Plus 2 or 3 independent traders, near as I can tell."
"I really hope it doesn't come to that," he said quietly.
At that moment, Lieutenant Del Mastro returned to the quarterdeck, armed and armored, with 4 sailors in tow. Malakasti, a thin woman with more tattoos than words in her vocabulary, had a shipwide reputation as a knife fighter. Dantier was a bearded, balding Varari who favored tattered nobleman's silks. He'd gone outlaw after a long career as a professional duelist. Big Konar, true to his name, was the largest slab of human flesh aboard the Orchid. And Rask, well, Rask was a type that Locke recognized almost immediately. A murderer's murderer. Drakasha, like many garistas back in Kamor, would keep him on a short leash and give him his head only when she needed blood on the wall. Lots of blood on the wall. A brutal crew, none of them young and none of them new to Drakasha's command. Locke pondered this while all hands were briefly mustered at the waist.
"Utgar has the ship," Drakasha announced. "We're not putting in tonight. I'm taking Del and a shore party to sound out the town. If all's well, we'll have a busy few days, and we'll start divvying up the shares tomorrow evening. Try not to gamble it all away to your watchmates before it's even in your hands, eh? In the meantime, Red Watch, mind the ship. Razor nets on starboard, stay up until we come back. Post lookouts up every mast and keep an eye on the waterline. Blue Watch, some of you sleep near the arms lockers if you're so inclined. Keep daggers and clubs at hand."
To Utgar, she said more quietly,
"Double guard on my cabin door all night."
"Aye, Captain."
Drakasha vanished into her cabin for a few moments. She re-emerged in her elderglass mosaic vest, with her sabers in fine jeweled scabbards, gleaming emeralds in her ears, and gold rings over the black leather gloves on her hands. Locke and Jean confronted her together, as unobtrusively as they could.
"Ravel, I do not have time."
"Captain," said Locke, "you've put together a bruising crew because you're out to scare someone who might give you trouble, haven't you? And if they're too stupid to take a hint, you want people who can end things quick. I strongly, strongly suggest that Jerome would serve you well on both counts." She stared at Jean, as though only just noticing the width of his shoulders and upper arms. "That might just add the finishing touch." "All right, Valora. You fancy a short night out?"
"I do," said Jean. "But I work best as part of a team. Orin is just the man to..."
"You two think you're so clever," said Drakasha, "but..."
"I mean it," said Jean hurriedly. "Humble apologies, but you've seen what he does. You'll have a pile of strong arms at your back. Bring him for situations unforeseen."
"Tonight is delicate business," said Drakasha. "Misstepping in Port Prodigal after midnight is like pissing on an angry snake. I need..."
"Ahem," said Locke. "Originally, we're from Camor."
"Be on the boat in 5 minutes," said Drakasha.
7. Drakasha took the bow, Del Mastro the stern, and everyone else an oar. At a stately pace, they scudded across the calm surface of the bay.
"At least that jackass finally stopped ringing the bell," muttered Jean.
He had taken a spot on the last rowing bench, next to Big Conar, so he could chat with Esri. She was trailing one of her hands in the water.
"Is that wise?" Jean asked.
"What, fiddling with the water?"
Esri hooked a thumb over her shoulder in the direction of the parlor passage outlet.
"You can't see them by night, but at the entrances to the bay there are rows of huge white stones set across the bottom. Regular lines of them."
"Eldrin stones," muttered Conar.
"They don't bother us," said Esri, "but nothing else will pass them. Not one single thing lives in this bay. You can swim at dusk with bloody cuts on your feet, and nothing will come along for a taste."
"But not too close to the docks."
"Piss," said Conar, almost apologetically.
"Well, damn," said Jean. "That sounds nice."
"Sure, I guess," said Esri. "Makes fishing a pain in the ass. Little boats crowd the Trader's Gate passage and muck up the works there more than usual. Speaking of mucking up the works..."
"Hmm?"
"I don't see the Red Messenger anywhere."
"Ah."
"But she was crawling like a snail," she said. "And we do have some interesting company in her place."
"Such as?"
"See that first row of ships? Starboard to larboard, that's Osprey, Piero Strozzi's lugger. His crew's tiny, and so's his ambition. But he could sail a barrel through a hurricane. Next to that, Regal Bitch, Captain Siobhan Rance. Rance is a pain in the ass. Has a real temper. Next is Draconic, Jacqueline Colvard's brig. She's reasonable, and she's been out here longer than anyone. That big three-master on the far end is the Dread Sovereign, Jafrim Rodinoff's lady. Nasty piece of work. Last I saw, she was on the beach getting careened, but now she looks ready for sea."
With 6 people pulling at the oars, they made short work of the trip. In just a few moments, they were alongside a crumbling stone jetty. As Jean secured his oar, he spied a man's corpse bobbing gently in the water.
"Ah," said Esri. "Poor bastard. That's the mark of a lively night in these parts."
Drakasha's shore party tied the boat to the very end of the jetty and went up as though boarding an enemy vessel, with wary hearts and hands near their weapons.
"Holy gods!"
exclaimed a mostly toothless drunk cradling a wineskin in the middle of the jetty.
"It's Drakasha, isn't it?"
"It is. Who are you?"
"Banji Talvo."
"Well," said Drakasha, "Banji Talvo, I'm making you responsible for the safety of the boat we just tied up.
But I...
If it's here when we come back, I'll give you a Ferrari Silver. If anything's happened to it, I'll ask around for you. And when I find you, I'll pull your God's damned eyes out.
I'll keep it like it were my own.
No, said Drakasha. Keep it like it's mine. She led them off the jetty and up a gently sloping sand path bordered by canvas tents, roofless log cabins, and partially collapsed stone buildings. Jean could hear the snores of sleeping people within those decrepit structures, plus the soft bleat of goats, the growls of mongrel dogs, and the flutter of agitated chickens. A few cook fires had burned down to coals, but there were no lanterns or alchemical lights hung out anywhere on this side of town. A pungent stream of piss and night soil was trickling down the right-hand side of the path, and Jean stepped carefully to avoid it, as well as a sprawled corpse damming the flow about 50 yards up from the jetty. The occasional semi-lucid drunk or pipe-smoker stared at them from various nooks and shadows, but they weren't spoken to until they crested a rise and found stones beneath their feet once again.
"Drakasha!"
shouted a corpulent man in leathers with blackened iron studs.
"Welcome back to civilization!"
The man carried a dim lantern in one hand and a bronze-ringed club in the other. Behind him was a taller fellow, scruffy and pot-bellied, armed with a long oak staff.
"Handsome Marcus," said Drakasha. "Gods, you get uglier every time I come back, like someone slowly sculpting an ass out of a human face. Who's the new charmer?"
"Guthrin! Wives' lad decided to give up sailing and join the rest of us big swinging cocks in the glamorous life."
"Yeah? Well," Drakasha said, holding out a closed fist and shaking it so that the coins inside clinked against one another. "I found these in the road. They belong to you?"
"I got a happy home for 'em right here. See now, Guthrin, that's the style. Show this lady some favor, and she returns the compliment. Fruitful voyage, Captain?"
"Belly's so full we can't swim any more, Marcus."
"Good on you, Captain. You'll want to hear from the shipbreaker, then?"
"Nobody wants to hear from that waste of a working asshole. But if he wants to open his purse and bend over, I've got a little something in wood and canvas for his collection."
"I'll pass the word. You in for the night?"
"Toehold, Marcus. Just here to fly the flag."
"Fine idea."
He glanced around briefly, and then his voice grew more serious.
"Chevron Rance has the high table at the Crimson, just so you can look all-knowing when you walk in the door."
"Obliged to you."
When the two men had strolled on their way down the path toward the jetty, Jean turned to Esri.
"Guards of some sort?"
"Maintainers," she said. "More like a gang. 60 or 70 of them. And they're what we have for order around here. Captains pay them a little out of every load they bring in, and they beat the rest of their living out of public nuisances. You can pretty much do as you like, as long as you hide the bodies and don't burn anything down or wake up half the city. Do that, and the maintainers come out to do a bit of maintaining."
"So what's flying the flag, exactly?"
"Gotta play these games sometimes," said Esri. "Let everyone in Prodigal know that Zemira's back, that she's got a hold full of swag, that she'll kick their heads in for looking at her cross-eyed, you know? Especially her brother and sister captains."
"Ah, I'm with you."
They entered the city proper. Here, at least, were the lights they'd seen from out in the bay, pouring from open windows and doors on both sides of the street. The buildings here had started as respectable stone homes and shops, but time and mischief had marked their faces. Broken windows were covered over with planking from ships or scraps of tattered sailcloth.
Many of the houses sprouted leaning wooden additions that looked unsafe to approach, let alone live in. Others grew wattle and daub third or fourth stories like mushrooms from their old roofs. Jean felt a sudden pang of grudging nostalgia. Drunkards lying senseless in the alleys, larcenous children eyeing their party from the shadows, maintainers in long leather coats thumping some poor bastard senseless behind a cart with no wheels, the sounds of swearing, argument, laughter, and ale sickness pouring from every open window and door. This place was, if not quite a fraternal relation to Camorre, at least a first cousin.
"Oh, kids!"
hollered someone from a second-story window.
"Oh, kids!"
Zamira acknowledged the drunken shout with a casual wave and turned right at a muddy crossroads. From the dark mouth of an alley, a heavy-set man stumbled, wearing nothing but soiled breeches. He had the glassy, unfocused eyes of a Jeremite powder smoker, and in his right hand was a serrated knife the length and width of Jean's forearm.
"Coin or suck," said the man,
threads of saliva dangling down his chin.
"Don't care, witch. Got needs. Give us a..."
If he was oblivious to the fact that he was facing 8 opponents, he wasn't oblivious to Rask knocking his blade hand aside and shoving him back into the alley by his neck. What happened next took only a few seconds. Jean heard a wet gurgle, and then Rask was stepping back out into the street, wiping one of his own knives on a rag. He threw this rag into the alley behind him and hooked his thumbs into his belt. Ezri and Drakasha seemed to think the incident not even worthy of comment, and they strolled on, casual as temple-goers on Penance Day morning.
"Here we are," said Ezri, as they reached the top of another small hill. A wide, half-paved square, its muddy sections criss-crossed by overlapping wagon tracks, was dominated by a fat, two-story building with a portico constructed around the chopped-off stern facing of an old ship. Time, weather, and no doubt countless brawls had scuffed and chipped its elaborate scrollwork, but people could be seen drinking and reveling behind the second-story windows in what would have been the great cabin. Where the rudder had once been mounted was now a heavy double door flanked by alchemical globes, the round, thick kind that were nearly impossible to break, in an approximation of stern lanterns.
"The tattered crimson," Ezri continued. "It's either the heart of Port Prodigal or the asshole, depending on your perspective."
To the left of the entryway was a ship's longboat, mounted to the building by heavy wooden struts and iron chains. A few human arms and legs seemed to be sticking out of it. As Jean watched, the doors to the tattered crimson slammed outward, and a pair of brutes emerged, carrying a limp old man between them. Without ceremony or pity, they heaved him into the boat, where his arrival caused some incoherent shouting and flailing of limbs.
"Now watch your step," said Ezri, grinning. "Get too drunk to stand, and they throw you overboard. Some nights there's 10 or 20 people piled up in that boat."
A moment later, Jean was squeezing past those brutes, into the familiar smells of a busy tavern at an hour closer to dawn than dinner. Sweat, scalded meat, puke, blood, smoke, and a dozen kinds of bad ale and wine, the bouquet of the civilized nightlife. The place looked to be constructed for a clientele that would be waging war not just on one another, but on the bar and pantry. The bar itself, at the far side of the room, was enclosed from countertop to ceiling by iron panels, leaving only 3 narrow windows through which the staff could serve drinks and food like archers firing from murder holes. There were only floor tables down here, in the Jureshti fashion, low surfaces around which men and women sat, knelt, or lay on scuffed cushions. In the cave-like fog of the dimly lit room, they played cards and dice, smoked, drank, arm-wrestled, argued, and tried to laugh off the attention of the prowling heavies who were obviously looking for candidates to toss into the boat outside. Conversation wavered as Drakasha's party appeared. Cries of "Orchids!" and "Zamira's back!" could be heard. Drakasha nodded to the room at large and slowly turned her gaze up to the second floor. Stairs went up either side of the common room. At the sides, the second floor was little more than a railed walkway. Above the bar and the entry, it expanded into wider balconies with Therin-style tables and chairs. Jean presumed that the high table was the one he'd glimpsed from the outside. A moment later, Drakasha began to move toward the stairs that led in that very direction. A sudden current of excitement rose in the air. Too many conversations halted absolutely. Too many eyes followed their passage. Jean cracked his knuckles and prepared himself for things to get interesting. Atop those stairs was a railed alcove, backed by the windows overlooking the darkened square from which they'd just come. Red silk banners hung in niches with alchemical globes behind them, giving off a low, vaguely ominous rose-tinted light. Two wide tables had been pushed together to accommodate a party of 12, all clearly sailors and toughs, much, Jean realized to his own amusement, like themselves.
"Zamira Drakasha," said the woman at the head of the table, rising from her chair. She was young, roughly Jean's own age, with the sun-browned skin and faint lines edging her eyes that told of years spent on the water. Her sand-coloured hair was drawn back into three tails, and though shorter than Zamira, she looked to outweigh her by about 2 stone. Tough and round, this one, with a well-worn sabre-hilt visible at her belt.
"Rance," said Drakasha. "Che, it's been a long night, love, and you know full well you're sitting at my table."
"That's damn peculiar. It's got our drinks on top of it, and our asses in its chairs. You think it's yours. Maybe you should take it with you when you're out of town."
"When I'm away on my business, you mean? Fighting my ship, flying the red flag. You know where the sea is, right? You've seen other captains coming and going."
"I don't have to break myself month in and month out, Drakasha. I just pick richer targets in the first place."
"You're not hearing me, Che. I really don't care what sort of dog gnaws bones at my place when I'm gone," said Drakasha. "But when I come back, I expect her to crawl under the table where she belongs."
Rance's people exploded out of their chairs, and she raised a hand, grinning fiercely.
"Pull steel, you dusty cunt, and I'll kill you fair in front of witnesses. Then the maintainers can haul your crew back to the docks for brawling, and Ezri here can see how your brats like the taste of her tits."
"Show your hand, Rance. You think you're fit to keep this spot?"
"Name the test, and I'll leave you weeping."
"We're going to have the house brutes on us," Jean whispered to Ezri.
"No," she said, waving him to silence. "Calling out isn't like plain brawling, especially not between captains."
"For the table!" shouted Drakasha, reaching for a half-empty bottle. "All the crimson as our witness, the contest is drinks. First on her ass takes a Surrey crew and moves down to the floor."
"I was hoping for something that'd take longer than 10 minutes, said Rance. "But I accept. You'll be my guest with that bottle."
Zamira looked around, then snatched 2 small clay cups of equal size from places previously occupied by Rance's crewfolk. She tossed their contents onto the tabletop, then refilled them from the bottle. It was white Kodari brandy, Jean saw, rough as turpentine, packing quite a sting. Rance's crew backed up against the windows, and Rance herself came around the table to stand beside Zamira. She lifted one of the cups.
"One thing," said Zamira. "You're gonna take your first drink Sairun fashion." "What the hell's that?"
"Means you drink it through your fucking eyes."
Drakasha's left arm was a blur as she whipped her own cup from the tabletop and dashed its contents into Rance's face. Before Rance could even scream, Drakasha's right arm came up just as fast. Her gloved fist, rings and all, met Rance's jaw with the sound of a cracking whip, and the younger woman hit the floor so hard the cups atop the table rattled.
"Are you down on your ass down there, love?
Or is that your head? Anybody think there's a difference?
Drakasha stood over Rance and slowly tipped the contents of the second clay cup into her own mouth. She swallowed it all without flinching and tossed the cup over her shoulder.
You said it was gonna be...
Before Rance's angry crewman, probably her first mate, could finish his protest, Locke stepped forward with his hand upraised.
Zamira kept her oath. The test was a drink, and your captain's on her ass.
But...
Your captain should have had the wit to be more specific, said Locke, and she lost. You going to take her oath back for her?
The man grabbed Locke by the front of his tunic. The two of them scuffled briefly and Jean darted forward, but before the situation went to hell, Rance's sailor was hauled back, grudgingly but firmly, by his friends.
"Who the hell are you, anyway?"
he shouted.
"Orin Ravel," said Locke.
"Never fucking heard of you!"
"I think you'll remember me, though."
Locke dangled a small leather pouch in front of the man.
"Got your purse, Prickles?"
"You motherfuck!"
Locke gave the purse a hard toss backward, and it landed somewhere down among the 100 or so patrons watching the action on the balcony with eyes wide and mouths open.
"Oops," said Locke, "but I'm sure you can rely on all the upstanding folks down there to keep it safe for you."
"Enough!" Zamira reached down, grabbed Rance by the collar, and hoisted her to a sitting position.
"Your captain called it, and your captain lost. Is she your captain?"
"Yes,"
said the man, scowling.
"Then keep her oath."
Zamira dragged Rance to the head of the stairs and knelt in front of her.
"Not such a very regal bitch after all, eh, Che?"
Rance reared back to spit blood in Drakasha's face, but the older captain's slap was faster, and the blood spewed out across the stairs.
"Two things," said Zamira. "First, I'm calling the council for tomorrow. I'll expect to see you there at the usual place and time. Nod your silly head."
Rance nodded slowly.
"Second, I don't have brats. I have a daughter and a son. And if you ever forget that again, I'll carve your fucking bones into toys for them."
With that, she heaved Rance down the stairs. By the time she landed in a heap at the bottom, her chagrined crew was hurrying after her under the triumphant stares of Drakasha's party.
"See you around, Orin Ravel," said the purseless sailor.
"Valtero," said Zamira sternly, "this was all business. Don't make it personal."
The man looked no happier, but he moved off with the rest of Rance's crew.
"That bit about your children sounded very personal," whispered Jean. "So I'm a hypocrite," muttered Drakasha. "You want to protest? You can take a drink, Siroon fashion."
Zamira moved to the rail overlooking the main floor and raised her voice to a shout.
"Zakorin! You hiding down there somewhere?"
"Hiding's the word, Drakasha,"
came a voice from behind the windows of the armored bar.
"War over yet?"
"If you've got a cask of anything that doesn't taste like pig sweat, send it up, and some meat, and Rance's bill. Poor dear needs all the help she can get."
There was an outbreak of laughter across the floor. Rance's crew, carrying her out by her arms and legs, didn't look even vaguely amused.
"So that's that,"
said Zamira, settling into the chair Rance had just vacated. "Make yourselves comfortable. Welcome to the high table at the Tattered Crimson."
"Well,"
said Jean, as he took a seat between Locke and Ezri,
"did that go as you hoped?"
"Oh, yeah," Ezri smirked at Drakasha. "Yeah, I'd say our flag is flown."
8. They did their best to look relaxed and amused for the better part of an hour, helping themselves to the Crimson's mediocre dark ale and all the better liquors Rance's crew had left behind. Grease-blanketed duck was the dish of the evening. Most of them treated it as decoration, but Rask and Konar gradually brutalized it down to a pile of bones.
"So what do we do now?" asked Locke.
"Word'll go out to all the usual vultures that we're back in," said Drakasha. "Less than a day or two, and they'll be courting us. Liquor and rations will go first, always easiest to sell. Nautical spares and stores we keep for ourselves. As for the silks and finer things, those independent traders moored at the hospital docks are our friends in that regard. They'll try to clean us out for 15% to 20% of market value. Good enough for us. Then they haul it back across the sea and sell it at full price with innocent smiles on their faces.
What about the messenger?
When she shows up, the shipbreaker will pay us a visit. He'll offer us piss in a clay bowl, and we'll talk him up to piss in a wooden jug. Then she's his problem. She's worth maybe 6,000 solari with her rigging intact. I'll be lucky to take him for anything near 2. His crew will take her east and sell her to some eager merchant for about 4, undercutting his competition and carving a fat profit at the same time.
Hell, said Lieutenant Del Mastro. Some of the ships on the Sea of Brass routes have been taken and resold 3 or 4 times.
This shipbreaker, said Locke, feeling a scheme in the berthing. I take it the fact that his trade is also his name means he doesn't have any competitors?
All dead, said Del Mastro, the ugly and publicly instructive way.
Captain, said Locke, how long will all of this take? It's nearly the end of the month, and...
I'm well aware of what day it is, Ravel. It takes as long as it takes. Maybe 3 days, maybe 7 or 8. While we're here, everyone on the crew gets at least 1 chance at a day and night ashore, too.
I haven't forgotten the matter you're concerned about, Drakasha said. I'll bring it to the council tomorrow. After that, we'll see.
Matter?
Del Mastro looked genuinely confused. Locke had been half expecting Jean to have told her by now, but apparently they'd been spending their private time in a wiser and more diverting fashion.
You'll find out tomorrow, Del. After all, you'll be at the council with me. No more on the subject, Ravel.
Right. Locke sipped beer and held up a finger. Something else, then. Let me request a few things of you in private before this shipbreaker comes calling. Maybe I can help you squeeze a higher price out of the fellow.
He's not a fellow, said Drakasha. He's as slippery as a pus-dipped turd and about as pleasant.
So much the better. Think on Master Nera. At least let me make the attempt.
No promises, said Zamira. I'll hear you at least.
Orchids, boomed a deep-voiced man as he appeared at the top of the stairs. Captain Drakasha, you know they're still pulling Rance's teeth out of the walls downstairs?
Rance fell ill with a sudden bout of discourtesy, said Zamira. Then she just fell.
Hello, Captain Rodanov. Rodanov was one of the largest men Locke had ever seen. He must have been just shy of 7 feet. He was about Zamira's age, and somewhat round in the belly. But his long, muscle-corded arms looked as though they'd be about right for strangling bears, and the fact that he didn't deign to carry a weapon said much. His face was long and heavy-jawed, his pale hair receding, and his eyes were bright with the satisfied humour of a man who feels himself equal to the world. Locke had seen his type before, among the better garistas of Camor, but none so towering. Even Big Konar could only outdo him in girth. Incongruously, his huge hands were wrapped around a pair of delicate wine bottles made of sapphire-coloured glass with silver ribbons below their corks.
"I took 100 bottles of last year's Lashani Blue out of a galleon a few months ago. I saved a few because I knew you had a taste for it. Welcome back."
"Welcome to the table, Captain."
At Drakasha's gesture, Ezri, Jean, Locke, and Konar shuffled 1 chair to the left, leaving the chair next to Zamira open. Jafrim settled into it and passed her the wine bottles. When she offered her right hand, he kissed it, then stuck out his tongue.
He said. I always wondered what Chavon would taste like.
He helped himself to a disused cup as Zamira laughed. Who's closest to the ale cask?
Allow me, said Locke.
Most of you I've met, said Rodanov. Rask, of course. I'm shocked as hell you're still alive. Dantier, Kona, good to see you. Malakasti, love. What Zamira got that I haven't? Wait, I'm not sure I want to know. And you?
He slipped an arm around Lieutenant Del Mastro and gave her a squeeze.
I didn't know Zamira still let children run free on deck. When are you going to reach your growth?
I grew in all the right directions.
She grinned and feigned a punch to his stomach.
You know, the only reason people think your ship's a three-master is because you're always standing on the quarter-deck.
If I take my breeches off, said Rodanov, it suddenly looks as though she's got four.
We might believe that if we hadn't seen enough naked Vadrans to know better, said Drakasha.
Well, I'm no shame to the old country, said Rodanov, as Locke passed him a full cup of beer. And I see you've been picking up new faces.
Here and there. Orin Ravel, Jerome Valora. This is Jafrim Rodanov, captain of the Dread Sovereign.
Your health and good fortune, said Rodanov, raising his cup. May your foes be unarmed and your ale unspoiled.
Foolish merchants and fine winds to chase them on, said Zamira, raising one of the wine bottles he'd given her.